Who's that?
Well, it's the committee bills.
Again, I'm not used to it.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to Legislative Days. And I would really like to say welcome to the Transportation Committee for November 13th, 2017. And we have two new members that are going to be joining our committee. And I'd just like to offer you a chance to say hello and introduce yourself. And so, Representative Salinas, would you like to go first?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you to the committee for welcoming me. My name is Andrea Salinas, and I am a newly appointed House member to House District 38, which is Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland.
And Representative
Andy Olson, State Representative of Albany, didn't want to be on this committee, so here I am.
But we are so happy to have you, and we needed you to balance out the committee. So,
Thank you.
That's the way it was. Okay. Today we're going to try and make sure that we have some opportunity for us to actually have some updates on some really important work that our agencies are doing for us. And we're going to start out with one that, if you've been on the committee, you've heard every year a little bit of an informational on an update on the Real ID Act compliance. And there's been a couple of actions by the federal government that causes us to ask for another update. And so I'd like to please invite our two staff members up to give us an update on what's happening with how Oregon is going to get this in place. And for our two new members, one member actually knows about it, but just make sure that you explain Real ID as you go.
Absolutely. Chair McLean and members of the committee, my name is Amy Joyce with the Oregon Department of Transportation, today here representing the DMV. And we were asked to come in and provide an update on the Real ID Act and Oregon's compliance with that federal law. So what is Real ID? It's a federal law that sets standards for states' driver's licenses and ID cards. It has 42 different elements to it in three sort of general categories. That is the reliability of the underlying information that people provide when they seek this credential, the security of the procedures that personnel use, and the security of the personnel themselves, and then the security of the actual plastic card itself. So 42 specific items underneath those three general categories. This act was passed in 2005. We're now here in 2017. The penalty for a state that does not comply with Real ID is not the typical type of penalty you see coming out of a federal law, which in the world of transportation typically is a reduction in federal funding. That is not the case here. The penalty for a state is that state's cards will not be acceptable for federal purposes, such as using it for identity to get into a nuclear facility, some federal buildings, some federal facilities like military bases, and eventually the ability to use that state's card to get through TSA to board a domestic commercial flight. Oregon is not compliant with Real ID, although in the 2017 session, the legislature did pass legislation, which I'll get to in just one moment. The primary ways in which Oregon is not compliant with Real ID are two. One is that Real ID will require the DMV to scan and store the documents that folks show to DMV to get a credential, so things like proof of identity, proof of legal presence, proof of residency in Oregon, and several other documents. They need to be scanned and stored by the department for 7 to 10 years at least. And then also, through Real ID, a number of federal systems have been set up by which the state is to verify those documents are accurate. So social security number, passports, birth certificates, that sort of thing. So those are the two primary ways that Oregon is not compliant. We don't do that today. In the 2017 session, there was legislative direction in Senate Bill 374 telling DMV that we should go ahead and begin to offer the option to people to get a Real ID credential. So the standard card will be the usual card that you obtain today, a driver's license or ID card. which I will mention is very secure. Oregon does a very secure document, so there aren't concerns there from the agency's perspective. But we are to begin offering a Real ID compliant version of each of the cards we issue. That becomes operative in that we begin to offer those cards in July of 2020. Now, the July 2020 operative date was done very intentionally to sync up with the driver's rollout of the service transformation program, of which many of you have already heard. But service transformation program, or STP, is the 10-year program to transform the way DMV deals with customers and serves customers. That was approved in 2015, and so we're 2 years into that 10-year program of the STP, and we have an IT vendor on site since July working with our DMV staff to begin configuring the commercial off-the-shelf product. But again, we won't be able to issue driver's licenses and ID cards in that new system until July of 2020, and therefore the operative date was set to sync with that so that we could use the capability of that new system to do this new level of work. So that's where we are today, and I think Tom's going to take...
Representative Vile.
Just real quick. So if, heaven forbid, we don't hit that date, what are our consequences? Are folks going to not be able to board planes and get into offices that they should be able to get into?
Chair McLean and Vice Chair Vile. Right. The consequence for not being compliant is that the state's cards won't be available to use as an identity document to board a plane with TSA. So, heaven forbid, if we don't hit those dates, that would be the consequence. So folks would need to use a different credential, such as a passport card, or other forms of ID that the TSA and others accept. I will say that the vendor that DMV is working with in the service transformation program has a very good track record in many other states where they've implemented the same type of system, and they are called FAST Corporation. They're called FAST for a reason. They are very successful in implementing on-time projects.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
And when are they expected to finish their work? In other words, we're not looking at they're going to be done June 30th and we're going to implement this July 1st, right? Because if, as I understand it, the way we've negotiated this with the feds is people have to have that card July of 2020. And so it's not just issuing that in July of 2020 and hoping that everybody comes in on day one and gets a new card.
Chair McLean and Vice Chair Vile, the final deadline from the feds under Real ID is October 10th, thank you, of 2020.
Okay.
So that is a short timeline, but the expectation both in the bill and from the vendor is July 1, 2020, we begin issuing driver's licenses under the new system, including the option for Real ID compliant cards. So that gives us from July through October 10 for those first folks to be able to have that Real ID compliant card to use for those purposes.
Wow, that's quick. Thanks.
Did you have
I do have
yes,
more.
Please. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. I get the good news part of this. We did, with the assistance of the governor, submit a request for another extension, which was submitted at the end of September. It was approved by the Department of Homeland Security in early October, and it goes through into October of 2018. So they granted a full 12-month extension. Like many other states, we received that extension. In getting the extension, we also were expected and did supply a more detailed implementation plan, if you will, with some interim milestones along the way to show our intent is to comply by that July 1, 2020 date. And with those specific milestones in there, some things that they can measure against our progress to show that we are intending to comply. We have agreed to provide quarterly updates to them at a schedule that they will set and provide updates as we achieve various milestones. And if there should be any extensions that we need to request, we'll be part of that process as well. We do anticipate and do plan to submit further extension requests. And in the extension request that the governor signed at the end of September, by saying July 1 of 2020, it certainly implies we're going to be coming back for more extensions. And they've accepted that plan and that time frame from us. So we fully expect, if we, again, show progress, show the commitment, that they will, again, grant another annual extension about this time next year, and hopefully at least one more after that. To further answer the question I think that was posed there, by saying July 1 of 2020, there is 3 months there that potentially they could grant another extension if we get into 2020 and we are a few days or a few weeks late with implementing a system. But that does not leave our customers much time if they want to have, and again, it's a choice, if they want to have that compliant card come October 1 of 2020. So
Madam Chair, how many other states are on this extension?
Chair McLean, Vice Chair Vial, I think there's 17. There's a total of 26 or 27 that are not compliant right now, that are either close to complying, that have requests into Homeland Security and just waiting for a response. There is a map in our materials. It's, if you got it electronically, it's in color. It helps a lot. It shows which states are in that we're reviewing, and the other 16 or 17 states like Oregon that are just have an extension, 12-month extension.
In looking at the material, I didn't see a copy of the plan that you sent off to them to get the extension. Is that possible to give it, put it on OLIS? Is that possible to put it on OLIS or give it to the committee members so that they could look at that, just so they have a better idea?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I believe it's with the materials.
Oh, it is with it. Okay.
The two-page letter from the governor.
Okay, I saw the letter.
It has a breakdown of the various federal provisions
and time frames.
So that's
what you sent in.
That's what we sent. Okay. Plus a Gantt chart, basically, with some color to show them milestones along the way of those remaining provisions. I think it's there.
Just wanted to make sure it's the same thing. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you. It's got an upgrade.
I just been dealing with a senator.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's not an upgrade. Come on.
Kidding. Thank you. A question. Does the Real ID double as a driver's license and as a federal ID card? If so, what does it look like?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, it's the same card, essentially. It just will have an identifier as being compliant or non-compliant.
Really? Okay.
The compliant card, in Oregon's case, will have a black star in the upper right corner of the standard driver's license. If it's a non-compliant card, and once we start issuing a compliant card, we also have to identify a non-compliant card. We'll say not for Real ID Act.
Hmm.
Very small print. It's going to be like 6-point font, I think, when we get it in there. But in the same location on the card, so that someone from a federal agency or at the airport with TSA, they can look to see if that card is a compliant card or not a compliant card.
Hmm. Yes. Follow up. More of a comment than anything. I really hope that TSA pays attention to this when it actually is produced and we have it in our possession. I flew 4 times in the last year with an expired driver's license, 4 times over 1 year, showing that they never, ever even checked the date of expiration of my driver's license.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing. Crazy.
He also drove on our roads for 30,000 miles.
Okay. So we're going to have Representative Meek, then we're going to have Representative Olson, and then Representative Vial will give you a chance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a quick question related to getting into the weeds of this. July 2020, my license doesn't expire until 2024. So in order for me to be compliant, I need to come in sometime after July 1st of 2020. And how's that going to work? You just come in and exchange? Is there an upgrade fee? I know there's an additional charge for the real ID, but what about the 4 years remaining on that?
Sure. Chair McLean and Vice Chair Meek, so a couple of elements to your question there. One of the elements then of obtaining a real ID credential is that you're going to have to go through the new processes. So you're going to bring back in your documents that I'm sure you've shown in the past if you've got a valid license now, your identity documents, your legal presence documents, your residency documents. You're going to start all over, a social security number on a document. Those will get scanned and saved, pinged against those federal systems, as I mentioned earlier, to verify that they're accurate and true. And then you're going to pay a fee. One element of Senate Bill 374 was that this federal mandate should be self-supporting. And so DMV is tasked with setting the sort of upcharge for getting a real ID. And the direction from the legislature is that we set the fee to cover all of the costs of implementing Real ID. So you'll pay the standard driver license fee plus some plus up amount. Then you'll be issued a Real ID, and it will be an 8-year credential. So you'll get the full 8 years, but what you will lose is the 4 years that you had remaining on your license. But you do get the full 8.
Representative Meek.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And so thank you very much. So I guess the more important question is, when we're getting close to the implementation of this, what type of outreach are we going to have to folks, for the citizens of Oregon, to let them know that they need to come in? Is it going to be a letter? Is it going to be a public campaign, publicity? How are we going to educate the population?
Chair McLean and Vice Chair Meek. A couple of points on that. So, first of all, Senate Bill 374 had a section that directed ODOT to do particular kinds of outreach on particular topics. And as backdrop, particularly for those who weren't here during the session, there was some controversy about whether Oregon should become Real ID compliant or not, and it was very important to some folks that there be the option to either get a compliant card or not get a compliant card, get the standard card. Therefore, part of the outreach needs to be, what does a Real ID card get you? What are the other options? What else could you show to TSA so that you don't have to get? So there are a number of different topics. Very important to that outreach will be, you know, here are the deadlines. This is exactly what you're going to need to do. These are exactly the documents you're going to need to bring in. Here's how much it will cost. Here's where you can go. We haven't gotten into the nitty-gritty details of implementation with a significant change like this. This could include, just as an example, you know, designating certain offices where you could go to get a real ID, or opening up satellite offices, you know, come here and get your real ID, or whatever that's going to be, because we do have that tight, very tight window. And we recognize that's a very tight window, and there could be a significant number of people who want to get this new thing, and we're going to have to figure that out. But that is, you know, better part of 3 years away and working through our new systems, but that is part of the implementation, is figuring out all the things we need to do and significant outreach to the public, and it was even baked into the bill by the legislature.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So, Amy, you mentioned earlier you were talking about secure system, and, you know, I can't help, because Representative Vile and I are on Judiciary together, and one of the bills that we're going to be looking at, not so much on the House side, but it's coming over from the Senate, deals with the data breach, especially Equifax and what's happened. I mean, we know 143 million people have been impacted by that. Nearly 11 million have been issues where their driver's license have been compromised. So I'm just kind of curious, I mean, how do we overcome things like that? Because obviously people are getting better at hacking. There's a lot of information out there on our driver's license.
Chair McLean, Representative Olson, I agree completely. And I think our state CIO would say you do the best you can with the equipment you have and the expertise that you have to try to fend them off. We will use the state data center. We'll use the encryption and the network, you know, protections that are in place for state agencies to use. And we are using, you know, vendors that know what they're doing. They have some good experience around this type of thing. is it foolproof? I'd be the last one to say it's foolproof, just based on the types of breaches that we see across the country and around the world. But we'll do the best we can to make sure that it is secure.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When the legislature passed the real ID piece of legislation, did that instruct you to, in essence, terminate the remaining years of a driver's license that drivers in this state have already paid for?
Chair McLean and Representative Witt, I believe it's in the bill that the credential is an 8-year credential, which is the maximum that we issue credentials for. So the indication is you pay for the license, you pay the upcharge for the real ID, and then it lasts the full 8 years.
Madam Chair, yes. But it was not instructive as to remaining years just falling by the wayside?
So I think I'm hearing is that if they have 2 years left on their license, mm-hmm. are you going to deduct a little bit of the fee because they've already paid for the next 2 years on any new license mm-hmm. that they get? Or is the fee that they are getting for the real ID, is it a new fee that simply starts after July of 2020? And so anything that they have left on their old license is not going to be counted as part of what they've already paid.
Chair McLean and Representative Witt, I think the answer to that is no, there won't be a deduction for the remaining years. Again, the bill instructed very clearly that ODOT DMV is to charge at least enough to recoup the costs of implementing Real ID. Hmm. And therefore, considering, we'll get to the fee conversation in a later part of this hearing, considering that we don't even recoup our costs when we issue a driver's license, the upcharge needs to cover that. I don't see any feasible way to do a deduction and recoup costs, but certainly there's nothing in the bill that says and do a pro rata deduction for the number of years.
Madam Chair, and I assume that there's nothing in the bill that says that you don't credit people for 2 years for which they have already paid, assuming that this program is prospective and not, it is prospective. So I can tell you that I was unaware of this. I voted for a bill that contained a provision that I was unaware of, and I will tell you that I was unaware of it. I suspect that the vast majority of my constituency was unaware of it, and this will go over like a lead balloon. And my only remaining question is, are we in the legislature going to have to respond to all the nasty correspondence that will result, or are you setting up an office over there to respond to all the correspondence that we're going to get? This is not going to fly very well with the general public. I know that as well as I know my own last name.
So I appreciate your comment and your question. I think you heard the comment and the question. I think there's more conversation for us to have as this is developed. And as we all know, there's always ways for us to tighten up or to add to any legislation that we've ever done. So thank you for those thoughts. I appreciate them. And you don't have to say anything else, nor do you have to make a response to that right now. But I do have Representative Vial who has another question. Which you'll find out he has lots.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a tag on to what Representative Olson was talking about. This whole cybersecurity issue is troubling me. And I know from Tom, your written materials, that you're doing nationwide name-based and fingerprint-based background checks on all the employees that will be involved in setting this thing up. That was supposed to start like this summer. Has that been ongoing now for a while?
Chair McLean, Vice Chair Vial, we've been doing the name-based criminal background checks for many years. I don't know exactly how many, but seven, eight, maybe 10 years. We've been doing that with our employees. What the federal provisions, though, seem to call for are fingerprint-based criminal background checks, which we do not do. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the provisions, if you look through the plan that we've laid out, and one of the milestones for us is by next summer to start doing that, fingerprint-based criminal background checks on new employees, on any volunteers that come that have access to the records. And I believe it also will include anyone who is promoted within the agency that hasn't had that type of a fingerprint-based background check. And we've submitted that to the Department of Homeland Security as our plan. And so far, they've accepted that. That is an appropriate implementation for us moving forward, rather than having all 850 of our employees immediately go through that fingerprint-based background check. They're accepting that we've done a reasonable check already, and then as we add new employees, we would do the fingerprint-based, more thorough type of a background check.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
So you're going to have to go back then and capture the fingerprint background check on everybody that you're hiring now.
Chair McLean, Vice Chair Vile, what I'm saying is I'm not sure that we're going to be required to go back if the person doesn't change their position. If they don't change their job, if they are promoted within the agency and change their job, it would trigger an automatic fingerprint-based criminal background check, which we do today for any employees that change their job. We do a name-based criminal background check. We would just augment that with a fingerprint-based approach.
So when... in the materials where it talks about July 2017 to June 2018, you're going to initiate and complete a project requiring name-based and fingerprint-based background checks. We're not there yet.
Vice Chair Vial, that's correct. We are in the process of doing that. We're 3 or 4 months into figuring out how that's going to work.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. My question is not going to be popular with you or anybody else, but here we go. So what I'm hearing is, for security, new people will be background checked, but unless they change jobs, there's no 4 or 5 year standard process by which we know that people haven't been committing crimes while working for you.
Chair McLean, Representative Evans, that's correct. There's no requirement in the federal law either, or the regulations.
That the federal law is messed up does not surprise or confuse me, but the part that I'm a little lost on is, for the state of Oregon, why, if it's deemed an issue that is of critical nature, thereby a background check is necessary to begin with, why wouldn't we have them every so often, or even randomized, to make sure that we have a secure workforce? I mean, in the military, we did that quite often.
Mm-hmm. Chair McLean, Representative Evans, we just don't have that kind of procedure. I'm not aware of other state agencies that do that. They may. But not within our agency. Is that a requirement?
So, as chair, I think what I'm seeing, I've heard two or three questions around security, and I've heard some questions about price. And so maybe it would be appropriate for future meetings that after you may have some dialogue and some opportunity to look at the opportunities out there for you to have a system like that or not.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could come back and give us a little update on what you're thinking on that process as you go forward.
That'd be great.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Does that sound reasonable?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, and Representative Meek has one more question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's a follow-up to Representative Witt's question. So, scenario, January 1st, 2020, somebody gets their license, are you going to be issuing an 8-year license on that? And so then they're going to, in order to be real ID compliant, they're going to have to come back in July and pay the full fee. Are we looking at maybe potentially, is that all we issue is an 8-year license, or is there other options when you're getting your driver's license?
Chair McLean, Vice Chair Meek, that's what we issue, is a standard 8-year license. The bill, Senate Bill 374, didn't call for any lesser amounts of time for issuance or lower fees as a result of that. It did indicate it was an option for people if they choose to obtain and possess a compliant card for that those federal purposes, they could do that, but they would pay a higher fee than for a standard license.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam.
Well, thank you very much for the presentation, and as I think we have a lot of interest, and I think we'll be looking forward to updates on how you're doing as far as process and working with the new vendor, and what the, you know, where we are on some of these questions of both cost and security.
Okay.
So thank you so much for being here, and thank you, Amy. Thank you, Tom. At this time, our next agenda item is a passenger rail update, and I do want to mention that I asked as a new chair for a list of all of the reports that folks were supposed to be making to us on a regular basis because of former legislative direction, and we have a number of them, and we've got a couple of them on the agenda today, and this is one that both we've asked for some, we personally at one of our last meetings asked a little bit more to be explained and updated on our passenger rail. So welcome.
Thank you. Chair McLean, members of the committee, my name is Hal Gard. I am the Rail and Public Transit Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I was told that there were some new members on the committee, so I prepared a little additional a little additional background just so folks understand what our passenger rail program is. The Pacific Northwest Passenger Rail Corridor is one of 11 federally designated intercity high-speed passenger rail corridors within the nation. It's designated by the U.S. DOT. The corridor has been operating since 1994, and this is the Amtrak Cascade service. It's distinct from Amtrak's national long-distance service, so this is a separate service completely. Oregon and Washington, we pay for this service. Federal subsidies went away in 2013, and in order to maintain the service, the states needed to pick up the cost. The corridor connects 18 cities across Pacific Northwest, and it's a 467-mile corridor, and it extends from Eugene, Oregon, all the way to Vancouver, British Columbia. There are a lot of stakeholders and players in the business. As I mentioned, ODOT and WashDOT pay for the service. We operate on both the UP line in Oregon, on BNSF's line in Washington. There is additional new line that was made as part of improvements up in Washington called the Point Defiance Bypass. That is owned by Sound Transit Service, so we are now operating over, or will be operating over that in December. Amtrak operates the service for us, and the fleet of seven trains are all manufactured by a Spanish manufacturing company called Talgo, and they provide all the maintenance on the seven train sets that operate along the corridor. We also augment down in Oregon our services with bus bridges, essentially. They're operated by a company called MTR Western. And, of course, FRA regulates the service, and FTA was the grant administration on the purchase of the two trains that Oregon owns and contributes to the service. We treat the Amtrak Cascades Corridor as a key piece of our statewide intercity connection. And we, where we don't have commercial service, we tie in state-sponsored service. So that key route along US 20 that connects Vail to Bend lost commercial service several years ago, and so we started operating service along that to make sure those connections. So the intercity piece ties really Oregon into the greater Cascadia economic region. I keep going the wrong way. In 2015, we were given legislative direction both to optimize ridership and to improve on-time performance issues. So we had seen since beginning of the service starting in 1994, we had seen steady growth of use of the system. You'll see a little spike there in 2000. That's when we added an additional round trip to the service. And we had steady growth all the way up until 2013. 2013, we started seeing a drop in ridership. It was very concerning. And we had to kind of pull apart issues to try to figure out what was causing that reduction in ridership. couple things seem to be really affecting it. More than anything else, we had a radical decrease in gas prices. I'll get to that in a little bit. We were having continuous problems with on-time performance. And we instituted a schedule change that we thought would be beneficial to the folks of the state, and we did not realize the ridership gains that we hoped to see from that. That was one of the issues that we were directed to do something a little bit different. This charts gas prices with ridership. They match very, very closely. And this is not just an Oregon problem. This is a national trend. So when gas prices are cheap, people tend to take the option of using their car as opposed to public transportation. And this applies not just to train ridership. It also applies to all forms of public transportation where we see that decrease. This is really a month-over-month graph of our ridership numbers. We have real seasonal fluctuations. We tend to see lower ridership in the wintertime. We get a little spike around spring break. We get gradual increases across the summer. And then we see another spike around the holiday season. That pronounced spike, the red line, which is this year's August trip, that's really the results of efforts we made to deal with congestion for the eclipse event. And we added two special trains from Portland to Salem to be able to get people down here to see totality, and it was hugely popular. Those trains sold out within 24 hours, and we had nearly 1,500 people take advantage of that service. So we were encouraged by that. So efforts we tried to do to optimize ridership, dealing with the schedule changes was one of the key steps that we really felt like we needed to take. A little bit of background here. Our partners up in Washington, they received a very, very large federal grant, nearly $1 billion, to improve the service on their section. The price of that was two additional round trips, so going from four to six round trips between Portland and Seattle. We knew that those additional round trips were going to have an effect upon the schedules in Oregon, and that's because the seven train sets that we operate work in rotation, coming in and out of maintenance. They have to work in a really complicated dance to make sure that we got coverage all up and down the state. We wanted to make sure that those schedule changes not only not impact us negatively, we wanted to get as much benefit as we possibly could out of those upcoming schedule changes, and those are to take effect this December. So late October 2015, we really, for lack of a better word, we started a pilot to see if we could find some schedule changes that we thought would be most beneficial to us. We shifted our northbound train that left Eugene at 5:30 in the morning to 9 o'clock in the morning. And what we saw as a result of that within 1 year was a 71% increase in ridership from that switch. And that's just a weekend. We were not messing with weekday travel. That was just a weekend change. And also on the weekends, we changed our morning departure southbound from Portland from 9:30 a.m. from 8:30 p.m. to 9:35 p.m. And again, we saw an increase of over 25%. So we were encouraged. We worked very closely with UP. With Washington, and one of the other key elements that was important just for cost savings, but as well as increasing ridership, was trying to make sure that anybody picking up a train to ride in Oregon, so southbound or even northbound, those trains were through trains. You didn't have to stop, get out, have a major delay at in Union Station in order to be able to continue your trip. So really our major goal was to make sure that those trains aligned. We also got cost savings because that decreases cost and crew times. It reduces per diem rates for folks having to spend the night in Eugene or Portland in order to be able to pick up another train. All those crew costs were factored in. In addition, we've been really trying to get the word out statewide, so we've been doing what we call tabling events, and that's where we try to find venues where folks are interested in train travel in, vacation excursions, that type of thing, and just be available, let folks know we have the service, what it connects to, how we can work it through. We also have discounted fares. I just left a bunch of coupons at the visitor desk out here in front, which is a buy one, get one fare coupon, which has been very, very popular. And we've handed out about 10,000 of those across the state. So this is the new schedule change that we're going to be enacting in December 18th. And really it changes our morning southbound from a 6 o'clock train to a 9:35 train and on the weekends. And Monday through Friday, that we'll be changing that train from a 9:45. Wait a minute, am I reading this right? I don't have my glasses on, so I have to look at this. Our southbound Monday through Friday, it's now 6 o'clock, and it'll be leaving at 9:45. Our evening southbound is now at 6:05 p.m. It'll stay. Our northbound train, currently it's Monday through Friday at 5:30. It will be changing to... to 9 a.m. And then we have a slightly later departure in the afternoon, so from 4 o'clock to 4:30. Okay, on-time performance. On-time performance is complicated, and it doesn't take a whole lot to affect it.
Sir, can we interrupt you for a question from Representative Meek?
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Madam Chair. I've already been getting communication from some folks in my district. They have been picking up the train heading southbound at the Oregon City stop, which I understand is going to be eliminated now.
Chair McClain, Representative Meek, the train will still stop in Oregon City. The concerns we've had is that we had a temporary bus stops there, and we had a couple things. We had very, very low ridership. We had about 7 folks using that bus southbound on that morning run, and it was adding between 35 and 45 minutes onto the overall schedule between Portland and Salem. And just economically, particularly since we had to adjust bus schedules to address these new schedules, we just couldn't make it pencil out economically. And we reached out to the folks at the train at Oregon City. We had it was an open house. It's an informational session. We provided folks with alternatives. We gave them schedules for other transit opportunities. We provided information around bound pools, tried to make it as painless as possible. But I do know that any time you change a schedule, you're going to inconvenience folks. And we just try to really do that sensitively as we can, but we also have to keep the economics in mind.
Yes.
So if I'm reading this correctly, though, so the current train leaves at 6 a.m., but now the change is going to leave at 9:45?
Correct.
So that'll change a lot of folks actually trying to get to work on time.
It will, and we've tried to make sure that we have bus schedules leaving from Portland that will align as best as possible. We have to be a little bit careful. We're looking at a 7 a.m. Bus. Folks are concerned that won't get them into work at time. There's a 6:30 Greyhound bus, which is right across from Union Station. And we have to be careful about not duplicating schedules, or we can get into trouble with federal regulations. So I'm aware of the concerns, and as I said, we've tried to be as sensitive as we possibly can.
Thank you.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, again, I sometimes need things in simple terms, so I apologize up front.
Sure.
We have 7 trains.
Chair McClain, Representative Adam, there are 7 trains in the service that operate between Vancouver and Eugene, and they work in rotation.
So on this schedule, figuring maybe 2 are in maintenance at any given time, so 5 are doing the loop-de-loop, there's in the morning going south from Portland to Salem, Eugene, there's 1 train. And it's going from, it's now changing to 9:45 a.m.?
In the morning, that is correct. So we run 2 round-trip trains. We had early morning southbound departure with a early morning northbound departure, and then an evening southbound departure and an evening northbound departure.
Could I have a follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So offline, because I know I don't want to take too much time today, but offline, I'll speak to you. I'm curious about what the investment would be to actually have trains every hour so people have an appetite and an expectation for utilizing them like they do in most other corridors in the country. So part of this might be that as you try to build a ridership, the uncertainties or the randomness of some of this, despite your best efforts, I'm not saying that, but just not enough trains, not enough trips. So
I'd like to maybe have a conversation offline.
Chair McLean and Representative Evans, I would love to have that conversation. We know for a fact that frequency is one of the best ways to build a ridership, but we do not have the resources nor the equipment right now to be able to do that. Okay. So that's why we augment with bus service.
And aren't we also talking about one rail, two rail, three rail systems? Because, I mean, the Washington State and California have two rails and three rails where you can actually get trains by trains that are like freight trains and those types of things, too. So it seems like that would have to be part of this.
Chair McLean, that is absolutely correct. And we pay through our operating agreement with Amtrak the privilege of operating on UP line. And to expand service on the UP lines would require us making investments in those lines. So one of the first steps we would look to do is be where can we find additional siding capacity, because freight trains don't have priority over passenger rail, but frequently the passenger trains get stuck in the siding because the freights are too long to occupy the sidings and allow the passing of the passenger train. So some of those logistical issues need to be worked out.
Thank you.
So unless I'm going to let them stand up and stretch because we're starting to act like my 6th and 7th period classes, I just want to say what we're going to try and do is get done with this issue by 3 o'clock. And so if you could just scope yourself to help us do that.
Thank you, Chair McLean. I'm just about done.
Okay.
So anyway, on-time performance. The other issues besides our own, freight interference, and we've had serious problems with mechanical issues. So we've had an older locomotive fleet that Amtrak provides for us. We expect to see vast improvements in that. Washington made the investment in 8 new charger locomotives that will be pulling our trains. And not only do we expect much better reliability on those locomotives, they also are much greener. So we're going to be seeing a greenhouse gas improvement. We've had continuous problems with late southbound trains originating out of Seattle. And if the train gets in late to Portland, it's going to be late for the rest of the trip. The improvements that Washington's made hopefully will result in increased on-time performance. In fact, they have an agreement with penalties with Burlington, with BNSF, to have an 88% on-time performance rate. So we're looking forward to those being implemented. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're in the Northwest, so we still have issues with weather, and we still are relying upon dispatching from the Class 1 railroads. And so that's an issue that we continually need to address. I'm just going to kind of end it on a hopeful note, maybe get you back on track. A couple things that we're acutely aware of. There are nearly 3 million people that live within 25 miles of the Cascades Corridor. There are nearly 900,000 jobs that are located within 10 miles of the Cascades Corridor. We're aware that our population is going to be growing, and we're looking at 35% increase in the next 25 years. And we know that our major population centers are going to be increasing between 39 to 48% over that same time period. So we see we continue to experience incredible congestion on I-5. That increases and grows. And we're hoping that we can continue to develop our Cascade service to help augment some of that issues. But we're a growth effort, mm-hmm. And we're trying to turn around some of the issues we've had as best we can. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Any other questions for our speaker? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very
for
much.
That.
I appreciate
and,
the time.
You know, as you're planning for the future, I think that, you know, hopefully that we're going to add to that maybe sort of a plan on how we're looking at things that we haven't tried. You showed us the things that you had tried. Okay. And I do think we have to bring in some of the bigger picture issues like the rail and the spurs and how they're not, you know, adequate to deal with some of the issues between providing space for both freight and passenger rail.
I couldn't agree more, Chair McLean.
Thank you very much. Okay, at this time, I believe, Amy Joyce, you're taking this one as well, and Tom. So, I would like to remind folks, and the title is supposed to be Overview of Oregon Department of Transportation Fee Streamlining, because this started last year, And if you remember, this was another report where they come back and report to us about their fees and if their fees are actually paying for the service. We've already heard a comment from Ms. Joyce about, you know, one of the services that we're not able to pay for with the fees that we're collecting. And there were also some streamlining and simplifying of the system that were goals that we had, and we'd given direction for them to come back and give us some ideas about how that would work and how they would look at the fees, because if there are too many of these fees that actually are not paying, you know, the actual full freight of the service, how many of them do we update or simplify or, you know, in some way produce a consistency or some kind of a system that's easy to understand for the general public. So the report today will be on that, and there could be a possible legislative concept that could go along with this, but right now we're getting the report of what some of these ideas are and how they have laid them out.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. We are here to talk to you about fees at DMV, one of the most important and popular topics you'll probably ever hear, DMV fees. Partly as a result of House Bill 2290 from the last session that did pass out of the House Transportation Committee, went to Ways and Means, we were asked to come back and provide some additional information. The bill proposed some cost recovery things, as you did mention, but also looking for some greater consistency and also some areas where we do services or provide products where there is no fee. We just believe there was an oversight, basically, in the drafting of some of the legislation over many, many years. Some elements of House Bill 2290 were adopted in the transportation funding package in House Bill 2017. However, there were still several things in that bill that did not pass that we thought we should bring back to you. We've been doing, DMV has been doing cost studies and fee studies. Initiated the first one in 2011. It was published in 2013. We developed a methodology that was reviewed by a group that we convened from Willamette University, some professors there that had a lot of experience, some former state employees also took a look at it and made some recommendations, and we followed that methodology in doing our first study. That was published in 2013. It had some basic fundamental assumptions that we put into it, first being that every cost should somehow be tied to some fee that we collect from individuals, so that the State Highway Fund isn't subsidizing certain operations that we have at DMV, that there should be some kind of a fee associated with a product or a service that we are delivering. Second was that any fee increases, and we knew there had been fee increases over the years at DMV, but that any fee increase that had been for a specific purpose, like highway construction or paying for bonds for highway construction, that those fees and those elements of those fees should still be attributed to those purposes for which they were either established or increased and not treated as part of our cost of delivering that particular service. An example would be establishing a knowledge test fee of, I think it's $5 that we charge right now. That was established actually in one of the transportation funding packages many years ago. And so presumably the cost of doing a knowledge test for an individual at a DMV would be part of the driver, driver licensing fee that we charge, because that's an activity that there isn't really a separate cost to be attributed to a separate fee necessarily. So we kept those things in mind. We knew, like I said, we knew there had been increases, but most of those increases actually had been for construction purposes, not for cost recovery purposes. We refreshed and redid the study in 2015 and in December of 2016. Refreshing in that we provided new transaction volumes, we did new timings of our activities, how long it takes an employee to do various tasks involved, and reissued in 2015 and then 2016. The bill that was introduced in 2017 was introduced using the study that was done in December of 2016. We intend to produce another report about this time next year, so late 2018 would be our time frame to produce another report. And as in the past, we fully anticipate there will be fees that are not fully recovering their costs associated with the activity. And we would presumably bring that back to you during the next session.
Chair McClain and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, just following up on some things that Tom mentioned. I would also mention that Legislative Fiscal Office, LFO, was involved in that group that oversaw the DMV's fee study. So there was an element of the legislative body involved in that oversight. So House Bill 2290, again introduced during the 2017 session, the House Transportation Policy Committee heard that bill, amended it significantly, reduced the number of fees that were to be increased to recover costs, and it was sent down to Ways and Means. We got a hearing in Ways and Means, but the bill didn't move forward. And as Tom mentioned, a few of those fees got pulled into House Bill 2017, the transportation funding package. Some of the streamlining efforts as well got pulled into 2017, which was also helpful. But there were a number of items, particularly in the streamlining and sort of equities sort of conversation that did not make it in. So a couple of things that did make it into House Bill 2017, title fees were made more consistent. A number of title fees were sort of all over the place. And so as part of that bill, title fees, which are one of the few sort of revenue raising items in the DMV fee structure, most are set to recover costs, but title and registration are specifically sort of profit-making items that then go into the highway fund to build and maintain the highway system. So title fees were made more consistent for ease of use, and certain permanent registration fees were also made consistent because they were sort of inconsistent for no really logical reason. So additional efficiencies or equities that could be gained that could be brought up in a future bill. One is mere reorganization. So many of our fee statutes, just over time, they sort of grow and grow and grow, and things get added. And after a while, they're a bit of a jumble. So there's just some pure reorganization that could be done. It's going to make it easier for customers to understand what they're paying and why. It's going to be easier for staff as we do that service transformation program and we configure fees. It's also, if we can reduce the complexity to fees, that will also be helpful.
Can I let Representative Evans interrupt you for just a minute for a question?
Thank you. And again, this is all good data, and I'm looking forward to hearing more. Just for the advisory group, we talked about this last year. I understand most of the academic heft is coming from Willamette, which is a great school, but involving some of the public schools that we actually are subsidizing would be helpful as well. To the extent that you can include Western, PSU, OSU, others, I think that would be helpful.
Good point.
Thank you.
And I remember that being, you know, one of the aspects that people were really pleased to see the schools involved in the study. So that's good.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative, for the comment. A second item where some efficiencies could be gained is rounding up nine fees. So we have nine fees in a certain section where they end with 50 cents, and just rounding up to a whole dollar amount. The complexity of DMVs are a little mind-boggling, and for customers to figure out what they're supposed to pay, for staff to figure out, the mere rounding up to a whole dollar amount would be very helpful. And thirdly, there are several items or products where there's no fee allowed in statute. So we do this thing without charging a fee, and yet there are very similar products for which there is a fee charged. And so it really, sort of on an equitable standpoint, if we're offering the same product by law, the fee really should be the same. So there are a number of fees where we're charging nothing, and probably it should be assessed the same fee. So that's, you know, really roughly what some ideas are to gain efficiencies and equities among fees that could come forward that would be helpful both to customers and to DMV.
Yes, Senator. I just did that again. Representative Vile. I've just
Everybody
been in a group where there were a bunch of senators. I'm sorry.
I'm horribly offended.
Vile.
No, I'm kidding. Thank you, Madam Chair. No implication in this question whatsoever, but have you had the courage to put this all in writing yet so we can kind of look at all these fees and start noodling over what we think?
Chair McLean and Vice Chair Vile, we provided a draft to former Chair McEwen that may have been passed on to now Chair McLean. It's actually a relatively short bill. I would also say that attached to our testimony is a short chart that shows exactly what's proposed. And since we're on the testimony, I'll just put in just a bit of a plug. The last page of the testimony is a chart that shows that, DMV is trying to do its part in terms of efficiencies. If you look at that chart, and it shows the really increasing number of our core transactions increasing significantly over time, and our FTE in that period actually has gone slightly down. So we are trying to do our part for efficiencies. Certainly STP will help in that regard, but that's where we are.
So thank you both very much for that. And if you don't find enough of that information in on OLIS or in your packet or information you've gotten, please let me know and we'll make sure you get the rest, because I think there might be a page or two that would be helpful.
Yeah.
If you didn't find it, it might be that. Okay, there are two things so I want to bring up as chair. And remember, thank you for putting up with a new chair. But we have two transportation committees now on both sides. And so we have the Joint Transportation Committee on, and it's supposed to be really focusing on the 2017 implementation. And we also have then a policy committee on the Senate side and on the House side. So some of these legislations, are we going to use committee bills to go forward with work that we've asked staff to do? And those types of things will be discussed in the last two items. But also remember that Co-Chair McEwen and I also have to get together with both the Speaker's office and the Majority Office to see where some of these bills are going to land. Specifically, you know, is it a policy House bill or is it a 2017 related bill? Do we both need to see them at least for information? And so we'll be working on that, and I hope that that system will look really efficient, effective, and productive. But we do need to have a little bit more time for us to kind of work on that. So right now I'm asking them to bring reports that I really do believe are important to us on a policy level, and that it doesn't hurt for us to have too much information. So thank you very much. I appreciate that. At this time, the next one's going to be real quick. This one, as far as discussion of possible committee bill or bill concepts, the only one that at the time that our former chair was in the seat, she had agreed that a committee bill could be looked at for this concept that we've just talked about. I agreed to go forward with that as well. And again, we still have that conversation about, is it going to come here for a vote or here for information, or is it going to go to the other committee, you know, for a vote or for information? I think it belongs to us, but then I have to get the sideboards on that conversation and make sure that there are others that might agree with me. So if you have any questions and or comments on that, please let me know. And if you need more information on what we just spoke about, please let me know. And if you have any ideas for committee bills that you think are important, that we're finishing some work or we're doing something that's of an emergency nature or something that is, it really needs to be done in 2018, simply can't wait to 2019, then please let's talk about that. And when we can actually vote on something, well, then we'll vote on our committee bills. And we have three opportunities for committee bills.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I can clarify.
Yes, and please.
If I can clarify the process, thank you. So the process is that in January, the committee will be voting to adopt committee bills that are in LC form in front of them, but they're also committee staff are authorized to only submit requests for drafting for three committee bill concepts as well. So it's a process that will have to happen by that. Those have to be submitted to Office of Legislative Council by next Tuesday, and so those drafting requests will have to be decided on which three. Up to three, Madam Chair, will be sent to Office of Legislative Council by next Tuesday.
So what I'm trying to do is be open, transparent, and so as I said, I'll be talking about this bill with Co-Chair McEwen and staff, and also talking to leadership and finding out if this one is going to be one that I hope that we will vote on. If there are others that you are having written as one of your two bills and hoping that it'll come here, as Patrick pointed out, that work has to be done by the deadline, which is Tuesday, I believe, November 21st of next week. It's the 21st, okay. Yeah. So anything else for the good of the order on this one? Yes?
I just want to say that if time gets short, I actually trust the leadership of the chair to determine what three need to be drafted for consideration.
Okay.
Because it is a particular weird aspect of the short session that there's a limit on what you can consider to consider. Mm-hmm. So I trust the chair to use that wisely if we're not assembled.
Okay. I appreciate that. Any other comments or any other concepts you want to talk about? All right. Thank you. Okay, at this time, then, we're going to go to the last item, and I believe that Patrick put by everyone's desk here a list of House Transportation Policy Committee research project suggestions, and I'm going to ask Patrick to go through this and where it came from. And most of you remember we had a conversation in this very committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, at our September meeting, we had a topic that one Representative McEwen had asked folks to members of the committee to suggest possible research topics. As you know, what used to be Committee Services is now the Legislative Policy and Research Office. We're taking on more of a research capacity than we had before. And so when we did that, we had a number of suggestions which are on that one pager that's in front of you that were put forward. They involved high-speed watercraft and its effect on non-motorist watercraft, commercial fishing and harvesting, and the integrity of riverbanks and river ecology. That was one. A review of how other states seek to balance movement of freight across different modes. That was the second one. The third one is securing and containing hazardous materials, including petroleum, carried by truck on Oregon roads, and how techniques and technologies that might be used elsewhere could benefit Oregon. The fourth one was looking into possible targeted investments in port infrastructure that could improve port resiliency in emergency situations such as earthquakes, tsunamis, and others for large-scale post-emergency response efforts, similar to what happened in with the hurricanes on the Gulf Coast. The fifth one was addressing concerns, including environmental concerns, related to possible construction of a third bridge over the Willamette in Salem. The sixth one was review of relatively high-speed traffic on major state highways and arterials that pass through downtown areas of rural, urban, and suburban communities and how that affects safety, connectivity, and commerce. And then the last one that came up was consideration of getting a comprehensive review of tolling and value/congestion pricing that is specifically directed towards House Bill 2017, but also in general.
So the only comment that I have about this list is that these ideas came from this group minus two. And so it's a situation where we have a research arm that is basically new, or at least it's being focused upon more in our administrative committee. What are we calling you guys?
LPRO is our colloquial.
So LPRO is available to do research for everyone on all committees, and we are offering this up as a committee decision or idea if you think there's a priority list here. Any individual can ask for a report, and there is confidentiality that you can have if you're just doing this report on your own. But if it is something that this general committee believes is important for us to do and we want to prioritize it, I think they're going to look at a committee, you know, prioritized research project before they're going to look at individual representatives or senators' projects. So maybe not, Patrick says, but we'll find that
it's
out.
That's less clear. I'm not sure about how we
there may not be sideboards on that yet, but I would think that 8 or 9 of us wanting the same thing might have some value.
Absolutely, that's true.
Okay. And so there's nothing to vote on today. This is, again, something that you can think about. We could certainly take this up at the January meeting and really give them some direction on this after you've looked at it. There also could possibly be other topics that you think are important that aren't here, and we have two new members that I want to offer you the opportunity to add to this list. So are there any comments, questions, thoughts?
Let me add to that. Sure. Some of these, as you may note, might cross kind of topic areas. And so we as an office operate with a number of policy experts in a number of areas. So there are some, I've already spoken to some of the staff that work with the emergency preparedness committees to talk about some of these issues. Some of them, probably the first one on that list, crosses over a little bit also into environment, natural resources a little bit. So some of these will be tag team efforts, which and some of them are more specific to transportation solely. But like I said, I think absent direction from the committee, the first one that I had planned to take up is the last one, ironically, on the list, the kind of trying to do a comprehensive review of tolling and congestion pricing.
And I have to be honest, that's something that affects for sure both committees.
Yeah.
And so I would say that there would be like, you know, 10 plus all of us. So there should be a lot of folks that are interested in that topic. Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would agree with that. I am not affected by anything like that down in my part of the world. But I did take an extended motor trip in the last 2 months. And got very familiar with tolling. In fact, I even got a picture of my truck running a toll plaza in the mail from one of our fine Midwest states, asking me, you know, why did you do this? And I told them because it was one of the most confusing things I've ever seen in my life. And so I just decided this was my best option. They said, well, we recognize it's very, very confusing. Just wad that up, throw it away, and call it good. So, you know, I just... that has really got my interest up, because the toll roads were the worst roads.
What state were you in?
Madam Chair, I don't
want to.
You're on the record.
I don't want to say that.
Because it is
the state of my birth, and I love my home state, and I don't want to
say that. Any other comments on this item? Okay, well, you've all been very patient with me, and I thank you. And if there's nothing else for the good of the order, we can conclude the meeting for today. I thought we got some good information. And welcome to our two new members. And thank you, staff, for all the updates. Our meeting for today, informational meeting, is closed. For today, informational meeting is closed.